Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues. But for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course. Use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Hi everyone, this is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.
Hi there, and welcome to my show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm your host, Bianca Murray. Today's episode is an extra special one because we're launching our amazing new segment, Books with Hooks, which I'm really excited about. In it, super agents Carly Waters and Cecilia Lira from PS Literary Agency will be reading the query letters and opening pages you submit for their feedback. This is a wonderful opportunity for you to test run your submissions so that when you get them in front of your dream agents, you'll make the best possible first impression by grabbing their attention. If you'd like to participate, email your query letter and the first 5 pages of your novel in one document to theshitaboutwriting@gmail.com. Please redact any information you don't want us to share on the podcast, like your name or the title of your work. After the Books with Hooks segment, we'll have today's guest, Rachel Spence, who's a freelance editor and who will be telling us everything we need to know about getting editorial help. So get ready, it's going to be a jam-packed episode. Let's begin with the first submission, which is from Submitter A, Novel A. Dear Miss Murray, I'm an avid listener of your podcast and actually shrieked out loud when you made the announcement on the most recent episode regarding the first 5-page critique. I follow Carly Waters on Instagram and would love to receive her feedback in addition to her colleague, Cece Lira, on my literary fiction novel. Maggie has been wrapped in the warm blanket of love provided by her boyfriend, Andrew. It's been easy for her to forget that springtide, her quaint village in the afterlife, is meant to be a temporary place to rest and reset. That is, until a catastrophe on the other side upsets the balance, and Andrew is born while she is left behind. To avoid being swallowed by her grief, she decides to push the boundaries of her familiar world while periodically finding herself within the expanse of Andrew's new living one. Rather than offering her comfort and support, however, Maggie's friendships are slowly unraveling. The closer she gets to reuniting with Andrew, the less she can trust the truth of her relationships with those most important to her. And through it all, why is the quiet gardener from downstairs so eager to discuss it all? Novel A is a 75,000-word adult novel that questions how deep the connections of love run, as well as the moral implications of that love. If the books Here, Now, and Then by Mike Chen and the Netflix show Dark caught your fancy, then this book is for you. I'm so excited to hear the next episode. Sincerely yours, Submitter A.
All right. I am looking at the query letter for Novel A. It's telling me that it is a 75,000-word adult novel. So all in all, I really actually thought this query letter was really well done. I thought that it really got to the point really quickly about it's the afterlife and the comps were really great. Here and Now and Then by Michael Chen, which is also a PS Literary author. So kudos to you for giving a PS Literary shout out, which was a great reference point for all of us. So yeah, I thought it was a really great query letter that explained everything really well. And so for me, that set me up pretty well to go into the novel. I was excited about it. It also kind of reminded me, not like right on the nose, but I worked on a novel called Maybe in Another Life by Taylor Jenkins Reid. So I'm interested in that kind of sliding doors thing. So it worked really well for me. So, you know, I was set up with, you know, great expectations and again, really excited to roll into this one. So as I started reading the sample, I kind of had to put the brakes on things because I couldn't, right from the first paragraph, I felt like we were making a move from a commercially written query letter with more commercial-ish comps to me. And again, maybe that was just my entry point and that's what I was expecting. But then we kind of rolled into a very literary sample. And, you know, I made some notes in the margins here, just like, you know, I just didn't quite understand it, didn't really, you know, couldn't really get into it really easily. And for me, because my taste, I would say, is on the more commercial dot market side, I probably would say this would be too literary for me in terms of my taste. So I also felt like the novel didn't really start until about page, in my notes, about page 6. There's a line that says, Maggie, I know you're with that boy. I know that boy isn't here anymore. Maybe talking about it would help. I'm a good listener, you know. I sighed, not feeling my chest expand, not feeling my breath in my lungs. I felt blank, empty. There's nothing anybody can do that would help. So for me, that was the beginning of the novel. So I thought the beginning was just kind of a bit of a literary setup. And again, could be my taste, but that was my take on it. I just thought that maybe it didn't start in the right place.
Yeah, I also enjoyed the query letter. I especially liked that the author showed a little bit of her personality because she mentioned she shrieked out loud when you, Bianca, made the announcement that Carly would be here to offer critique. So I thought that was really nice. I always like it when authors include a little bit of their personality. It hit all the marks, like we know what the word count is, we know what the novel is about. So that's great. Would have liked to hear a little bit more about the author, like maybe, I don't know, something about her writing credentials. Even if you don't think you have one, sometimes you do, like listening to this podcast, although she did mention that. But in terms of the writing, I thought that it didn't start in the right place. Agree with Carly's take. And I would add that to me, the place where it started was a little confusing. So she's looking at her reflection. And then there are a few references that I, you know, had to read twice to understand. So you do want to start your novel, not only in really interesting place with tension. Tension is always super important. But I always think that, you know, a good way to start a novel is with a shorter sentence. Either that or a sentence that is promising something that is going to come. This is just two tricks. There's obviously lots of ways to start a novel, but this is something that I feel like if she were to edit this first paragraph, and I feel like she could, that might make it a little tighter and then better. There's also a point on page 2, where someone walks into the store, his name is Oliver, and he says, Maggie, may I? And then, you know, she interrupts him by going, Oliver, I actually avoid this at the start of the novel, I'd say, only because when you show two characters interrupting each other, this works really well to show what is being unsaid, but we only know what's being unsaid, meaning what's, you know, packed inside a sentence, what the person can't quite get themselves to say. because they're stumbling once we get to know the characters a little bit more. And if that's not the intention, if the intention is really just to show that they were talking over each other, then it's not necessary, right? Right in the beginning, keep the pace going. I feel like this will be really eerie and atmospheric. And I love that. I love that in novel. I would just add a little bit of tension. And I will say to that point that a lot of really successful authors don't start their first or even second or third drafts with tension. They add that, they layer that afterwards. So never feel discouraged when someone says, well, I don't see enough tension here. You can just add that later if that critique makes sense to you. A lot of authors do that, and that's okay.
Do you have an example of the kind of tension you would recommend that she adds, something like specific that she can think about, or not necessarily?
So I do think that the reference of the boy not being here anymore that Carly mentioned is actually a great, great example. But since this is the afterlife, and we know this because of the query letter, perhaps also something referencing something mystical or magical or spiritual, as long as it's something that's foreshadowing something big that's about to come. And I don't, people oftentimes when I say this, people think big, like an explosion. No, no, this is literary fiction. That's okay. But something tense. So the boy that isn't there anymore and that's a problem is a good example of that.
Okay. Carly, did you have anything you wanted to add to that or no?
One thing that's really interesting and most intriguing about this literary fiction is that it is about the afterlife and it is a bit of a hook, which is great for literary fiction. It's great to have a hook. And so obviously us reading this right after the query, we have a bit of an entry point. Somebody picking up this future book is probably going to read the back cover copy. So nobody is really going to come to this cold, but editors will review this as a cold submission in the sense that they will be coming to it for the first time. And with an editor eagle eye, that's something that they will pick up. So you just need to remember that we do need to make sure that we do have an access point for people to get right into it. And so, you know, obviously there are going to be things that people come to this with in terms of their expectations. Like something I think about when I read this pitch was the Good Life, that TV show. Obviously it's completely commercial and comedic and completely different tone, but again, like these are little reference points that we come to it with. So, you know, again, we want to think a little bit about what people are coming to it with and their expectations. So I would talk a little bit about what the afterlife looks like maybe, or how it's perceived, instead of going right into the character development stuff here. I would probably start with a little bit about that.
And just on that, do you think that the first person best serves this kind of story that requires a lot of world building? Because, you know, the problem with first person narratives is that this is normal for this character. Where they live is entirely normal for them. So they're not as likely to observe things that the reader definitely desperately needs to be observed in order for the reader to make sense of the situation. Whereas if you write something in the third person, you can give a lot more context to the world because it's more natural for the narrator to be commenting on things like that. Or do you not necessarily think that's a problem in this kind of story?
I would say, now that you've brought that to my attention, that seems very, very astute and makes a lot of sense. Yeah, because my taste is more kind of commercial to upmarket, and I don't tend to go into capital L literary fiction unless it has a big hook. But that's one of the reasons I'm drawn to this, is because I do think it has a hook. And I think that is what makes literary fiction, you know, accessible and has that potential to cross into the mainstream. So because, you know, you're kind of giving us everything that we want in terms of what publishing professionals look for in literary fiction and looking for breaking out literary fiction, I do agree. I think that world building in this case would be extremely important. And Bianca said third person, and I do think that would probably draw us in much better.
I definitely agree with the assessment. Very astute. I'm now going to use that wisdom. I do feel that oftentimes with point of view, it's nice to play around with it. So, you know, if the author hasn't yet, I feel like trying a different point of view might work really well, even if only as an exercise. So much of figuring out your own novel is listening to what the pages are going to tell you, but they can't tell you things if you're not trying new ways to do it.
Absolutely. And my observation just comes from personal experience. I prefer writing in the first person. That's my natural setting. In my last novel, there was three narrators, and one of them I had to do in the third person purely because she was living in an informal settlement in the squatter camp in South Africa. And this is such a different world to what any of my North American readers were used to, that even though it wasn't fantasy or sci-fi, I had to do a certain degree of world building for the reader to get on the page with what was happening. And it never felt authentic to me trying to do the world building in the first person, because it just felt like the
this character was giving the reader exposition for exposition's sake, as opposed to it being organic. Whereas when you write something in the third person, as the narrator, you have so much more leeway in which to play around with these things. So that's something for you to consider, submitter A.
Now let's look at submitter B, novel B. Dear Carly, Cecilia, and Bianca, novel B, which is an 80,000 word smart book club fiction novel, is a dysfunctional family drama centered on Elian, a 26-year-old startup supervisor whose life gets upended when she receives a letter from her father, written before his death from pancreatic cancer 7 years prior. He urges her to find and reconcile with her mother, whose sudden disappearance when Elian was a toddler has never been explained to her. Elian's life further unravels when she gets fired, runs out of money, and moves in with Grandma, whose health is declining. Elian must overcome her family's stubborn silence to piece together the truth about her mother's disappearance, or risk ending up aimless and alone. In a story that mines adultery, arson, and exile, and a quest that spans from California to Philadelphia to Italy, novel B pairs an abandoned female protagonist similar to that of The Queen's Gambit with the style and family secrets of The Most Fun We Ever Had. I was a cum laude English major at Yale and received my MBA from UCLA. I'm currently plotting my second novel from my temporary home of Florence, Italy. My short fiction has been nominated for a Pushcart Prize and has been published in Defenestration, Flash Fiction Magazine, Reflex, and Writer's Advice. Thank you for your consideration, and I look forward to hearing from you soon.
So novel B, the query letter hits all the right marks. I know that it's 80,000 words. I know that it's book club fiction. I know that it's centered around dysfunctional family drama. I personally love that so much. In terms of the story, I like that the author is telling me what happened. I wonder if perhaps she could share a little bit less, only because she does get into a bit of detail. Like, obviously, I haven't read the whole novel, so maybe this isn't too much detail. But I would recommend, you know, on first glance, tightening up a little bit and just removing so many details. There's a part where she writes, Elian's life further unravels when she gets fired, runs out of money, and moves in with Grandma, whose health is declining. I don't think we need that sentence. We could start with the following sentence that says, Elian must overcome her family's stubborn silence to piece together the truth about her mother's disappearance, or even the following one. I'm not sure, but you could condense that sentence a little bit more. I like the comps. I like that the protagonist is similar to The Queen's Gambit. I love The Most Fun We Ever Had. It's a novel. I love that. I like that she included her writing credentials. So overall, I thought this was a really well-written letter. She actually references a second novel that she's plotting. So that shows a career author. And I like seeing that. So yeah, I really enjoyed this query letter.
Okay, so the query letter for novel B, I also love dysfunctional family dramas. That's just like coffee in my cup. Absolutely love it. Need it every day. So that part was great. So I felt like we're moving into the second paragraph. I felt like we were kind of pitching two different books. So we had the little bit about life unraveling, the little bit of the family drama, stubborn silence, mother's disappearance. And then we get into this bit about in a story that mines adultery, arson, exile, quest that spans from California to Philadelphia to Italy. Like, to me, like, we're packing like almost two different novels into this one little paragraph. And so I felt like the note that I made on this was that I felt like sometimes authors try to pitch a query letter in the sense that they're trying to make us know what is common about their story, in terms of like, here's, you know, they do the whole like, her life was normal until it was chaotic, or it was this, and her marriage was normal until this happened. And so instead of focusing on what is common about the story, focusing on what is unique about it, to me, is more important. So not doing the, you know, you're going to like it because you have a clean entry point into it. No, you're going to like it because it's completely dramatic and unique. And that's why I thought the adultery, arson, exile, like, you don't, again, you don't have to give away the end if there's some sort of like mystery that's going to happen. But I want to know more about the adultery, arson, and exile element of it, as opposed to the, you know, again, normal everyday life of life unraveling, grandma, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, I would just kind of like almost flip that. So I would talk a little bit about a little bit more about that kind of drama before we talk about why her life is more straightforward. To me, that I think that would just be more interesting and compelling, focusing on what is unique instead of what is more common about the story. And the other thing, yes, love the comp. So Queen's Gambit, most one we ever had, great entry points, also very different. So when comps are really, really kind of far away in terms of whether it's historical moments or genres or anything, like these comps are pretty far apart. You know, Queen's Gambit was written in the 80s. Most fun we ever had was written a couple of years ago. You know, we have historical context. We have so much going on. And so again, I think what pulls these two comps together is the family dysfunction, you know, I assume, which is great. But yeah, so I would say I'm a little worried the Queen's Gambit is being used as a, like, here's a really topical thing that everybody likes right now, as opposed to a comp that really like digs in and tells us more about the book. Cause I didn't really get the sense that this is a historical novel. So, you know, again, Queen's Gambit, love that show, binged it in, you know, 6 hours or however long it was. But yeah, I would just put a little bit of question mark in my mind about whether we would use that comp title in the eventual pitch letter to editors.
Something that I found interesting is that things that we consider historical fiction, the Historical Fiction Society does not consider historical fiction. So apparently a story has to take place 50 years in the past for the Historical Fiction Society to consider something historical fiction.
That's really interesting. I always ask editors about that too. You know, what qualifies as historical fiction, because I think anything, they kind of consider anything historical that's about 20 years in the past, which is a bit strange to me. but yeah, so that's interesting that the Historical Novel Society feels differently.
Listen, considering COVID, I consider last year historical fiction, man. So, okay, what were you going to say about the bio, Carly?
Oh, I was just going to dip into the bio, but ultimately my note was just great. Loved it. You know, covered all the bases here in terms of education, second novel, all of that sort of stuff was really great. Love the bio.
It's a very well-written query, for sure.
Okay, let's go into the pages.
So the novel starts off with the protagonist finding a letter. And I love novels that start off like this, because I feel like it's a great way to get your reader to ask questions. So much of starting a novel is about getting the reader to ask the right questions, like, oh my gosh, what's this letter going to be about? Who sent it? What's going to happen after she reads it? So I was asking all the right questions, and that was great. I also enjoyed that the author set me in scene right away, so I could smell what was going on. She mentions smelling the peppery tang of cooked garlic and ginger. I could see what the character was doing. There was a sharp visual about the lake. I like that. So that was great, like immersing in scene. You'd be surprised how many times I don't get that right off the bat, and I do appreciate it. I felt that, so here's what happens. The protagonist finds this letter. We get to read the letter. And that's basically it, right? We get a little bit of her reaction, or actually we don't, and that's what I'll get into after she reads the letter. Two comments on that. One is, I felt like the letter could use with a little bit of tweaking so that the voice sounds more like her dad. This letter is from the protagonist's father. I felt like it didn't quite sound like someone's dad writing that letter. It felt like someone who was younger. I don't know. I do think that that could be tweaked a little bit, just to make it sound distinct from the protagonist's voice. Another thing is that, well, here's the thing. The protagonist's father died, I think it was 7 years ago. I'm not sure. And she found a letter written by her dad before he died. Like, that's a huge thing. We need to see her emotional reaction after she reads that letter. I'm inside her head. This is third person close. So I was super excited to go on that journey. This is personal for me. Like, I lost my dad 5 years ago, right? So if I found a letter that he had written before he died to me, like, and again, I'm totally projecting my own life here, but I would be really, really interested in seeing her emotional reaction. And we don't get that. After she reads the letter, she has her best friend with her. And I like the best friend character a lot, by the way. That was really well done. I'll read the line. She looked up and saw Crosby at the doorway, hands clasped behind her back like a Degas dancer, a tear like a dewdrop trailing down her cheek. Crosby cried empathy tears at movies, at books, at three-legged dogs, even at seeing someone give up their seat for an older person on the subway. Notice how we're talking about Crosby, the best friend. I want to be inside Elian's. Is it Elian and Lion? I don't know. I want to be inside the protagonist's head. I want to feel, all I get from her emotional state is finally feeling calmer. She released the hug. I want more. Like, and this, by the way, is a good thing. Like, me wanting more is a sign that your story is interesting. So please, this is third person close. This is a protagonist. You're starting off the novel. Just, I want to know more about her head.
I found novel B to be similarly intriguing. I really enjoyed, you know, the whole, like, was it her mom on the postcard in the mailbox, little entry point. I thought that was great. And I also really liked the letter that Cece was talking about, but I want to unpack that a little bit because I felt really torn about the letter. I like that it is like the hook that comes out really early, but I am a little bit concerned because we don't know these characters very well. And whenever this kind of reminds me of like the prologue problem, when the reader is asked to do a lot of the kind of emotional heavy lifting on their own, and they just don't have an entry point into anything about the characters or why this matters or their emotional state at this time. And so I feel like the letter was trying to be used as like, you know, the five alarm fire to start the novel, when I actually don't think that's the five alarm fire. I think that we need something else to be the kind of, you know, inciting incident to get to know the characters. Like, well, it could even be like Elian coming home to some sort of drama that her roommate was having, you know, like enter with drama, but I don't think the letter is the drama because I don't think we know the characters well enough. And so again, could be any sort of drama. She's out for her run and she like rolls her ankle and a neighbor has to help her home, just like anything other than the letter to start with, but quickly follow with the letter. So it's like, okay, entry point into the character, then follow with the letter so that we kind of have like a double whammy back to back in terms of emotional drama. I just don't think the letter can carry the inciting incident at this time, but love it as a trope. You know, I think it's great. It's just, you're just asking the reader to do a lot more heavy lifting than they're able to at this point, which results in people putting it down.
And our third query letter. Dear Cecilia, I first became familiar with you and your work while listening to Bianca Murray's podcast, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing, when I heard you were looking for compelling memoirs and have a soft spot for feminist issues and women's stories. I immediately jotted your name down. Today, I would like to submit my book To All the Boys I Never Loved for your consideration. To All the Boys I Never Loved, complete at 100,000 words, is a comedic memoir written from the perspective of a 30-something straight cisgender woman who has been dating since her teenage years, but has never been in love. This book is a brutally honest, shockingly vulgar, and charmingly witty recount of the life of a single woman who sees her ever-expanding breakup roster as a collection of successful learning experiences rather than failures. It will appeal to readers who appreciate the crass humor of Mandy Stadtmiller's Unwifeable, the raw candor of Michelle Parise's Alone, A Love Story, and the refreshing tenacity of Glynis McNichol's No One Tells You This. To All the Boys I Never Loved takes the reader on a humorous and heart-wrenching journey of self-discovery and self-love amidst the complexities of relationships, but more importantly, breakups. From my days as a teenage virgin, when a trip to the doctor for acne remedying birth control led to the confusing discovery of my immaculate conception, to my tumultuous 20s when I happily made myself a mere receptacle for unsolicited dick pics, non-consensual sexual encounters, and incurable STIs, and now in my early 30s when I finally learned what I really wanted out of a relationship from the most unlikely of sources, my married boyfriend. I deep dive into my experiences with every issue surrounding love, except love itself, and share how I've grown to embrace my chronically single status. I have been a storyteller all my life through acting, singing, radio broadcasting, and my career in PR and communications, transient in more than just my romantic entanglements. I have lived in Nova Scotia, Berlin, and Toronto, where I currently reside with my canine life partner, Sally. You can find me on social media through my personal profile and recently created platforms I've launched to build a following for my content. My hope is to be a published comedic author telling stories that women can relate to, laugh at, and learn from. But in the meantime, I'll settle for airing my dirty laundry on social media in exchange for digital validation. Please contact me if you would like to see the complete manuscript. Thank you for your time and consideration. Sincerely, Kendra.
Right. So I'm looking at the query letter for the project called To All the Boys I've Never Loved. So right away for me, I felt like the title was too similar to All the Boys I've Loved Before, which was the YA novel. So it was a little bit hard for me to kind of flip gears once I found out this was a comedic memoir written from the perspective of a 30-something-year-old woman. And also the word boys in the title didn't really work for me because it's an adult project. And then I kind of felt like a little bit icky about that. So if we were replacing this in the adult category, I do think we need a more adult title. So that was kind of my first take on that. I also felt like there was a lot of... I was feeling a little bit disjointed about the fact that it's a memoir. And so sometimes in query letters, when authors are pitching memoir, they feel like they need a lot of flowery language to be talking about themselves, when I feel like the writing has to do it for it. And so so there was just a couple examples of some adverbs that I just thought were a little bit heavy: brutally honest, shockingly vulgar, charmingly witty. In other paragraphs, there's a lot of adverbs like that as well. And so I think something stronger when you just say this book is an honest, vulgar, witty book, right? And so I just feel like focusing on not, you don't have to woo me as an agent, you know, you just have to tell me like what the goods are. So so I would have just liked to hit that a little bit harder. And again, that would just bring down the word count of this query, because I do think the query is a little bit long. So yeah, that was kind of my first take on the first two points. The next was the comp. We kind of move into that. I love Glynis McNichol's No One Tells You This. Such an amazing, amazing, amazing book. So that was an excellent comp and a very good comp. So I thought that was very well done. And the next section kind of takes us into what the actual plot of the book was. And so I felt like we're starting off with some, again, a little bit of flowery language, in the sense that heart-wrenching journey, self-discovery, self-love, nothing wrong with those points or those words, but as an agent and a reader, I'm going to figure that out myself about your book. So let's try to get to like the gritty goods here. So then the next part that's great is teenage virgin, immaculate conception, tumultuous 20s, you know, we're getting into the goods there. So I would just, you know, take out some of that flowery language. Again, it will just cut down on word count. And then, so now our third paragraph here, we're getting into the author bio. And so I really like that the author in some pages, we have like an Instagram, a TikTok, and I think a Twitter link, which is great. But I just want to make sure that we kind of talk about the difference between a platform-driven book and kind of a, like a book that is just pitched on, you know, the quality of the goods itself. And so by including all that information about the following that you're kind of launching, I think that is great. But I do think this is the case where it can't kind of be considered a platform book, because, you know, we need followers somewhere around the kind of 10,000, 20,000, 30,000, kind of up to 100,000 to call this like a platform-driven book. So I just want to make sure that the author really focuses on pitching this as purely based on how interesting it is and the quality of the actual work itself, as opposed to calling it a platform-driven book.
I like that she started off by referencing the podcast, only because it shows that she's done her research. That's always good. I do feel like the first paragraph could be one sentence long. I always recommend authors to lean into their powers of brevity, and that less is more in a query letter. This is quite long. I agree with Carly's point about the title, and also really enjoyed the comps. So in the third paragraph, there's a sentence where she says, "From my days as a teenage virgin, when a trip to the doctor for acne remedying birth control led to the confusing discovery of my immaculate conception." So immediately I was like, "Wait, what?" So that really piqued my interest. She mentions, you know, a few other things that are just as shocking. I don't know if that would be the right word, but that, you know, definitely kept me wanting more. So I would just condense this a lot, make it a lot shorter, stick to these three or four things that are, I guess, really different about your life, intriguing. And yeah, just make this a lot shorter, I think. Not because it's not good, it is, but rather because less is more. We don't need all this. I thought it was really sweet that she referenced her dog, only because I'm such a dog lover and I always like knowing that people like dogs too. But again, we don't need all this information, right? Like I would keep it shorter to make this stand out even more. Like this would be an even stronger letter if it were shorter.
Okay, so now onto the sample chapters. Carly, would you like to begin with those?
So the author starts off with an introduction to enter into the book. So I would say that I really enjoyed the writing. I don't have a single critique about the writing itself. But again, I always kind of come back to the idea of whether this is where the book starts, and especially with a memoir, which draws that, straddles the line between it is nonfiction, but it kind of has to read like a novel. And so I don't think that an introduction is necessary. I would actually prefer that we kind of just get right into it. And so I don't really think we need a recap necessarily, or a grounding moment necessarily, because I think we're going to spend the whole book with you. So I think I would rather start off with actual kind of like plotty memoir memoir as opposed to an introduction memoir. So
I'm a huge fan of memoirs. I 100% agree with Carly. We do not need an introduction. Please, please, please just take me to the actual writing. I am so eager to go on that journey with you. And a memoir is supposed to read like a novel. This is very, very important. It's the secret to writing a memoir. If you treat it like fiction, not in the sense that you're making it up, but in the sense that you're following all the rules of fiction of keeping the reader engaged, of offering plot and setting and character. And if you start with an introduction, it doesn't feel like fiction. It feels like nonfiction. And people pick up memoirs because they like the feeling of a novel, but with the added intrigue that it's real life. So strongly, strongly recommend this author to just jump right in. Her story's clearly interesting. So just do that. I also enjoyed the writing. I felt that, and again, because this is an introduction, this is just a general memoir tip for anyone. Remember that memoirs are all about scene, secrets, and shame. So you always have to keep us in scene, even if that's stream of consciousness, that's fine. But I need to know where I am in your story. There has to be some type of secret, some type of reveal. It doesn't have to be the most bombastic secret of life, but there has to be something that you're keeping or that someone is keeping or a promise of something. And shame really is an umbrella term that I'm using for any unsavory emotion. You can't be a perfect person feeling perfect things. And it's not that this is what's going on right here, but it does seem like there's no conflict. The author is very clear about saying, so I've dated all these guys and I've never fallen in love. And it's okay because I'm content in my life. And I had great parents who loved each other a lot and were a happily married couple. And all the couples around me were also wonderful and I'm okay. So because she's telling me that she's okay, I'm thinking to myself, well, then what's the point? I am very happy that you're okay, but I want there to be drama. I want there to be conflict and tension. So we need conflict and tension here. And I'll just say it, right? Like, I don't buy it. I don't buy that you're okay. No one's okay, first of all. Second of all, if you want to tell the story, there's something there. So I would unpack it and I would remember that right now you are relating a story to us as opposed to revealing a story to us. Relating a story is when you say, I went to the grocery store. Revealing a story is, I went to the grocery store and I shoplifted. Like, what? Why did you shoplift? You know, like, why would you do that? What's going on in your life that you have felt like you had to do that? Or is it a compulsion? What is it? Like, there has to be an element there of intrigue. And in memoir, this is so important. And I'm like the biggest fan of memoir. So I feel like a huge challenge is that authors, they often, their memoirs, their first drafts especially, tend to read like journaling as opposed to storytelling. So these are my many thoughts. I love memoirs, as you can see.
And just in terms of what you said, so perhaps the writer now is fine with everything, but this needs to be kind of a character arc. Even if it's memoir, you need to show that there's been this baptism of fire, all these things that happened that at the time were not okay, but now you zen, and this is how you got to the part where you were zen. Because in the query letter, we have things like it's raw, it's honest, it's vulgar, there are shocking moments, etc. So I think to start with one of those is a good way to really draw the reader in and to show them this journey of discovery that the author went through in writing this novel and in going through all of these experiences. Because for me, that's another thing about a memoir. It's that this is where I started and this is where I ended. And this is how I changed in the process of going through all of these things.
Fully agree. 100% agree. And don't tell us that you're okay right off the bat, right? Like, I think it's the third paragraph, or maybe it's, despite my earlier question, the question is that, you know, why has she never fallen in love? And she was crying when she asked that question. Despite my earlier question, written in the depths of a recent heartbreak, courtesy of one of my non-relationship breakups, I live pretty contently most of the time. Again, you're right, Bianca. Like, if that's the case now, great, because it means that you went through a journey and you're okay now. That's actually wonderful. But don't tell me that. Take me on the journey, show your struggles and show the character arc that you're going to undergo. And then at the end, I'll find out that you're okay. You never want, can you imagine any story, any fairy tale, any major story being like, in the end, it's all okay, guys. But then let's go follow the hero's journey. No, that's, you don't want that. You want the tension to be on the page. And right. I get why she did it. She was trying to reassure us. I appreciate that.
I just want to go back to the vulgarity element, because sometimes I feel like vulgarity can be used as something to hide behind. And so I feel like when you say you're going to be vulgar, it's, again, I love it. Let's be honest about women's lives. Like, let's get right into it. You know, no shame. Like, I'm all here for it. But I think in some ways hiding behind the vulgarity of the language, it's kind of like sex addiction. Like, what are you hiding behind? And what are you like, what, where are the secrets that are going on behind yourself? And by being sex forward, great, like love sex positivity, all good. But like, what are we trying to unpack emotionally? And that's why I felt like the introduction kept us at arm's length in a way where I didn't want to be at arm's length, right? Like, I want to be with you, as Cece said, in the scene. And so I feel like the job of this type of memoir is actually to make us more uncomfortable than comfortable. And as Cece said, she's trying to make us comfortable, and I don't want to be comfortable, right? Like, I picked up this book to be uncomfortable, to be challenged, to talk about things that might be taboo. And if you're going to write it in a vulgar way, again, fine with me. Let's back it up with some like deep emotionality about why we got to this state. And so, yeah, I think being in the scene, because again, like, there's so many memoirs we could reference here, but you know, there's things like Wild, right? Where she's getting into the sex addiction and using that as a crutch. And also I'm currently reading, or listening to, I should say, Jessica Simpson's Open Book, which is an amazing, amazing memoir where she just mines her whole childhood, all of the darkness, you know, which led her to the light kind of thing. Right. And so we need that kind of like that down up, you know, valley to peak thing that Bianca was talking about. So yeah, I feel like there's a lot here. And again, we're trying to critique something based off 6 pages, right? So yeah. we're not able to kind of, you know, delve deep in a way that I think we all want to. And the fact that we want to talk so much about this project also makes me feel like there's so much good here and so much that could be really successful. So yeah, I think we all want this to succeed. So it's just about, you know, figuring out what the story is and getting us in scene.
Yeah. And show us the messy bits up front, you know, show us like the rock bottom, the messy, ugly stuff up front, so that we read to find out that you did turn out fine on the other side.
I just wanted to say thank you guys so much for sharing your work with us. I know that it is an extremely vulnerable thing to do. As agents, we don't take this lightly. Our careers are built on the back of writers being vulnerable with us. And we appreciate that so much. We just want all of you to, you know, get better through listening through our critiques of other people's work. And I'm so glad to be a part of this. Thank you, Bianca.
Thank you to all the writers who shared their work. It's an incredibly brave thing to do. My admiration is with you. I so appreciate it. It's an honor to get to read your work. It's always an honor. And I wish we could do this with every single critique we get. So thank you for this, Bianca. Thank you for this opportunity.
And Cece and Carly, I know how incredibly busy you both are. And for you to take time out to read these submissions and chat with me, I hugely appreciate it. And I know very much that our listeners will as well. So thank you very much for that.
Carly Waters will be running a 90-minute webinar on identifying and cultivating your author brand on the 11th of March at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. To register for that, head over to Carly's Instagram page, where you'll find the link in her bio. Also, don't forget that I've got various creative writing courses coming up. Head to my author page at biancamurray.com to get more information on dates, fees, and registration details.
We just registered my youngest kid for kindergarten. I cannot believe it. One of the tricky things about my kids being in French immersion school and not having French as a language myself is I'm honestly worried about how I'm going to assist with homework as they get bigger. They're young now, but I see it coming. We are honestly so lucky though to live in a city that's bilingual, and we have bilingual friends and Francophone friends. So I know it's going to be easy for our kids to pick it up. Me, on the other hand, I am worried about me. I grew up somewhere where French class was not taken seriously, and now I have to make up the difference. And that's where Rosetta Stone comes in. As the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, it really immerses you in the language you want to learn. Rosetta Stone teaches through immersion, which is a proven way to learn a language. Instead of memorizing and drilling vocabulary words, you learn by matching audio from native speakers to visuals, reading stories, participating in dialogues, and other practical language skills to fast track your ability to communicate fluently. There are no English translations in the product. You're honestly getting trained to listen, speak, read, write, and think in your new language, which is what everybody wants. Rosetta Stone users especially love the speech recognition feature. As you practice speaking, Rosetta Stone uses advanced voice recognition technology to match your audio, the audio from native speakers, and then give you feedback on how well you're pronunciating the words so you can really hone those pronunciations. It offers 25 languages from Spanish, French, Italian, German, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, even Dutch, Arabic, and Polish. This is the best language program because they have been an expert in the language learning field for 30 years and used by millions. Thousands of companies and government organizations use Rosetta Stone to support language training online. Of all the apps, Rosetta Stone uses the best speech recognition technology, so it compares your sound waves to those of a native speaker for better feedback to improve. They have a patented speech recognition engine called True Accent, which is built into the program. As you practice speaking, you'll get feedback on how well you're pronunciating words.
The other language learning apps use speech recognition to detect what you said, but Rosetta Stone tells you how well you said it compared to native speakers. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Think about the cost of a one-month language course. Think about the cost of one-hour private tutoring sessions. With Rosetta Stone, you enjoy lifetime membership and accessibility on desktop or app. We have a special offer for you guys. It's 50% off. That's a lifetime access to 25 language courses on Rosetta Stone for 50% off. This is a steal. Do not put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, the Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. We want you guys to go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre or time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 2nd of June, with the matchup emails going out on the 3rd of June. For more information and to register, go to biancamurray.com, look for the beta reader matchup page, and please spread the word. The more writers we have signed up, the better the matches will be. Today's guest has a BA and MA in English from the University of Toronto and a publishing certificate from Ryerson University. She has been an in-house editor for over 3 years, including most recently working as an acquisitions editor at Dundon Press in Toronto. In this role, she acquired literary fiction, genre fiction, memoir, biography, and young adult fiction. She has also been working as a freelance editor for over 7 years. In her spare time, she enjoys reading, discussing grammar, and spending time with her pets. I love her already. It's my pleasure to welcome Rachel Spence. Rachel, thank you so much for joining us today. It's lovely to have you on the show. Could you begin by letting us know what kind of services you offer to writers and what your qualifications are?
So I am a professional editor, which basically means that I have a publishing certificate from an actual, in my case, from Ryerson University, but there's also college courses that offer that. I'm also a member of Editors Canada, which is the only Canadian organization for editors. And that's kind of the nuts and bolts of it. Beyond that, a lot of that is, you know, it's experience. I have in-house experience, I have freelancing experience, and now I'm primarily freelancing, which means that I'm working directly with, you know, writers and in different situations that you have with companies, things like that, to edit for them. So for myself, I do anything from developmental editing, right, which is the big picture editing. I also do copy editing, which is a little more kind of nuts and bolts, looking at kind of grammar and kind of smaller structural stuff. And then I also do proofreading, which is generally something I do more with publishing companies. For that, I also, because I have an acquisitions editing background, I also offer consultation services. And it's kind of anywhere kind of in around that realm. Anything I can do to help writers, basically any answer questions they have, work with them on their project. And yeah, and I always enjoy having people reach out with questions.
Wonderful. So the question here is, for a lot of beginner writers, is why do they need to hire an editor early on in the process? If their book is going to be sold to a publisher and they're going to work with an editor, why do they need to incur the cost of an editor early on in the process? So could you take us through that?
It's an excellent question. And it is one I encounter pretty regularly, whether indirectly or not. But really what it comes down to is competition, right? There are far more projects out there than there are publishing houses that can publish books. So because of that, right, you need to have an edge. You need to, whether it's, you know, quality writing, a very good, well-developed idea, anything in and around that realm. And oftentimes it doesn't really matter how talented a writer you are, an editor can help you get there. Because you have some writers who are like, their prose is absolutely beautiful, but their book just doesn't hold together and they just can't figure out how to fix it. So by going to an editor, you can actually get someone who knows what they're doing and who works on books regularly to be like, look, here's your weaknesses, this is why it's not working, you know, like anything in around there. And an editor will do that. And oftentimes I've also encountered people who are, you know, who are maybe maybe, or just don't haven't done research to kind of understand how much an editor might cost and things like that. And that's another thing I always recommend too is, you know, do your research. Definitely ask questions when you reach out to editors to get a sense of what projects they work on, how much it should cost, so that that way everybody's comfortable as well. Also, reach out to more than one editor, right? You want to make sure you're going to be working with someone and investing this time and money with someone who you know is going to not only, you know, help you deliver a good quality product, but is actually someone that you'll enjoy working with and you might want to work with again. Because editors are find a good editor, it usually means it's a longer relationship than just someone looking at a few things for you. And, you know, going back to, you know, the question itself, by doing that and by having a much stronger product, if you're looking for an agent, if you're submitting directly to publishing houses, they're going to notice, right? They're going to be like, oh, that's in really good shape. So because if something is in really good shape and it's also good, they're going to be far more willing to acquire it because it means it's going to cost them less money, which means their bottom line is going to be better because all publishing houses always have to play that line, right? Especially the indies. None of them have a lot of money, right? So anything that can help so that it kind of checks both boxes, it's great for them.
And, you know, something I didn't realize when I was an emerging writer is that, you know, I was of the opinion you finish this book, you finish the first draft of it, and you're so impressed with yourself that you finished a book. And I mean, it is a huge accomplishment to finish a book because of all the people who start writing books, there's a small percentage who actually finish an entire book. But still, that's the point at which writers tend to immediately send it off trying to query agents. And of course, firstly, agents have got so many submissions coming in on a weekly basis. Their slush piles are enormous. And most agents that I speak to say that they only give a manuscript kind of 5 to 10 pages before they decide if they're even going to continue with it. So if those 5 to 10 pages aren't really, really polished, they immediately going to close the file and move on to the next project.
And that's assuming they even make it to the manuscript, because the cover letter, the editorial letter, whatever you want to call it, right? Which it's basically, you know, you're telling a bit about yourself, you're giving information about the book. If it is way over the top confidence wise, or you can tell this person is like incapable of, say, I don't know, summarizing their project, or it could be littered with spelling errors or a whole multitude of problems. And if, you know, if you look at that and you're like, oh God, this looks awful, then you might not even make it to the manuscript. I remember I used to manage the slush pile when I was at Dundurn. And there were times where, like, depending on what it was, I'd be like, okay, I'm not even going to look at that. Or if I was feeling generous, maybe I wouldn't. I'd look at the first paragraph. This is the thing too, is you may say like kind of 5 to 10 pages. If something looks maybe promising, I might give it to 20, but I usually know on that first page whether or not something has potential. The first line of that book, if it doesn't hook me, or if it's strange, or if it has the word boobs in it, yes, this really happened. I'm probably not going to read more, or I'm going to show it to my colleague, but that's a whole separate thing.
Okay, so take us through the process. Let's say that somebody wants to work with an editor and they reach out to you. We'll discuss costs associated shortly, but for now, I'm just looking at the process. How does that work? How do you and the writer agree upon the kind of editing that gets done? Let's focus specifically on, say, developmental editing, because I feel like that is where independent editors or consultants add the most value.
Yes, I would agree with that. Well, you know, so of course, first step, of course, is to, you know, for an author to reach out to editors. And usually as part of it, like for myself anyway, what I always ask for before I give an estimate is I always like to see the full manuscript. The full manuscript is actually very important. And that's for many reasons, in part so I can for sure, like I can verify the word length, I can verify the genre, I can verify a whole bunch of things, including how much work it needs and what shape it's in. Like, especially say if you have like urban fantasy novel, but it's a, you know, it's a type so you don't necessarily start in the world, you kind of discover the world as you go. But then if I only have the first 30 pages, then you haven't even really gotten to the fantasy part, then I'm like, I have no idea what's going on in your book. So, you know, that's always, you know, something that does come up at times too. So it's a full manuscript. I like to always learn a bit about the author, because you have some authors who say, you know, have published before or are completely new. What are their backgrounds? You know, where are they coming from? It's not necessarily just like a, you know, are you educated? It's also just to get a sense of where they're coming from. Do they participate kind of in workshops? Maybe what kind of industry do they work in? Like just to get a sense of kind of where their headspace is as well. I also like to talk a bit about budget, which is always, you know, a bit uncomfortable for people anytime, you know, we have to talk about money, but coming in with a clear budget can be really helpful, because then if I know, if there's an author who's like, okay, I only have this amount of money, but I'm interested in this level of editing, then I can counter and be like, okay, well, with this amount, I can do this. So how about this? This is a bit of a compromise. So it's part of it. It's really sharing as much information kind of on both sides to get to that middle ground. But the big thing that authors should always know is that even with estimates, and this goes for with any editors, is that all estimates, generally speaking, are negotiable. They're also usually given as a range. Every editor has their own way of doing it. I tend to give ranges. But so you just, you know, it's a conversation. So if an editor kind of comes in and is like, okay, well, I'm looking at this range for your project, you know, they'll probably explain a bit why they're giving that number. Not like saying huge detail on the mathematical side, but like they're going to be like, okay, well, your project definitely needs this amount of work. I've noticed these things already. It could be that maybe, you know, structurally there's obvious problems, things like that, because an editor will always look through the material, even briefly, to spend like 5-10 minutes just getting a sense of the project. They'll also want to get a sense of whether it's the right project for them, because every editor works on different projects and has different skill sets, which is also why going on even like the Editors Canada website, which has its own online database of editors, and you can actually go on there and you can read profiles of different editors, as well as you can get their contact information that way as well. And by going through Editors Canada, higher chance that you're going to be connecting with a quality editor as well, because they are a member of the association, rather than just trying to do kind of like a Google search and just kind of hope for the best. That way, it's definitely a method I recommend.
So once they've decided that you're the person that they want to work with and you've agreed to a fee structure, etc., what is the general process? They submit, let's say it's an 80,000 word manuscript, which is kind of standard. They submit it to you, and then how does the process work from there?
So the process, it depends on what we've agreed on, as well as what, and again, somewhat that agreement is too, is also say, and I'll just say me, just, you know, from my position as an editor, if this was my project, usually I'm pretty clear with my recommendations. If I think that there's a chance that this might need more than one pass, because there are some obvious like larger structural issues, so I don't want to get into the smaller structural issues until we fix the larger ones, then maybe we'll agree that there's going to be multiple passes as part of that, in which case then, you know, there'll be a schedule. There will always be, you know, well, anytime you're going into that, there's an agreement that most editors, and myself included, will have authors sign for a larger project. And in it, it'll outline any kind of, you know, the fee schedule, you know, the actual like work schedule, all that kind of stuff gets laid out in there. So, you know, the process itself. So usually I'll be really clear about, say, what my deadline is and how long I have to work on things. I'm also someone who likes to communicate a lot too. So I usually will reach out and just give a bit of an idea of like, okay, so here I've started, or like I've noticed these things about more to come, that kind of thing. When I'm done with I'm actually doing the edit, I always write up some kind of editorial letter as well, just so that it basically summarizes, say, the changes I've found and things like that. It's also where, if I'm doing manuscript evaluations, I always do a nice detailed editorial letter, which is also another thing that I haven't brought up yet, but they're a great step, if especially for authors who are completely sure that maybe the book is where it needs to be to really get the value they want from a developmental edit. Doing something like a manuscript evaluation is a great middle ground, because it's far cheaper and you still get, so you get kind of the really kind of big picture, more of a broad kind of look at things, right? But it's still a great way to have someone come in with you know, really good experience and be like, okay, this is what's working, this isn't what's working. So your next revision, kind of, these are the areas to focus on. And that's really what kind of the evaluation is for. Developmental editing is, you know, a lot more hands-on, right? You're looking, okay, so these are kind of these issues, but then you're pointing out and working really specifically in different areas of the manuscript to really kind of dig into it. But I have seen manuscripts where I've looked at them and I'm like, as part of that kind of evaluating with the estimates and things like that, and been like, okay, well, you might want to consider this instead, because I'm not sure if they quite get the value of the developmental edit yet. But we could, you know, so yeah, just have that middle ground of kind of just trying to do what's best for the author while also, you know, making sure that the project gets the support it needs. So it's just lots of, it's always middle ground and negotiating and just you know, I'm someone who's very kind of author focused, probably again, just because between it just being me and between being an acquisitions editor, you always want to kind of build that relationship with the author as well, so that they have confidence in what you're both in spending the money on you, but also, you know, in feeling the value that they get from the project. I also often have calls or, you know, video chats, things like that with authors, especially for larger projects. That way we can actually talk through some things, which has been really helpful for people I've worked with as well. But it's not something that everyone does, but it is something that I like to do.
Yeah, that leads into something else. So I know a whole bunch of emerging writers who actually want to work with an editor as they are writing. They want somebody who mm-hmm. they can bounce ideas off of and do things like plot development and brainstorming with along the way. They don't want to wait until the manuscript is completely done in order to get a manuscript evaluation. So if there's someone who wants to be working with an editor along the way, having perhaps two discussions a month in terms of where the story's going, mm-hmm. is that something that you would also be open to?
Absolutely. It's something I've done before as well. Especially with, you know, recently I've worked with the Rights Factory, and that's actually what I did there, especially, was working with projects from the beginning and kind of working with authors as I went through it and having regular calls and looking at, in this case, was an essay collection. And, you know, so going even like an essay at a time and, you know, having feedback and back and forth with drafts and all kinds of things. I love being able to really dig into things and help shape things from the ground up. And again, with something like that, you just got to kind of negotiate with the editors, right? Be clear on, for authors, it's important for them to be clear on what, you know, what they're looking for and what they would like to get. And then you find a balance with, say, you know, whether it's the money or the time or whatever.
And just in terms of when you look at manuscripts, whether it's an evaluation or developmental edit, what are sort of the three biggest issues that you tend to find in first draft manuscripts? Is it structural? Is it that there's too many characters? Is it that, you know, the plot doesn't hold together? What are the commonalities that you find?
It depends on the genre. I'll start there. But generally speaking, yeah, it's usually, oftentimes it is larger structural stuff. It's things that, you know, as something that I always say to authors too, is that there's always often a problem of underwriting generally, which is usually when, you know, there's more in the author's head than what's on the page, right? Because if it's your own work, right, you're not reading it in a way where you're like, oh, that information is missing, because it's in your head. So you're automatically filling in the details. So that could, especially if it's something that's more maybe like fantasy, sci-fi, alternate reality, you know, speculative fiction, anything like that, where you have to do more major world building, I often see weakness there. But, you know, but it could even be for like a personal essay collection, right? What holds the essays together? And that goes for short story collections as well, which I've also worked on, you know, is it gets that larger picture of, okay, why are these together? Why would they want to read this? Why should they read this? And just really kind of finding those overarching themes and plots and things that hold it all together. Characterization can be a tricky one as well. Again, even with the underwriting, but sometimes you have characters where you're just like, I don't mean for this character to not be likable, but I don't know how to fix this, right? Maybe you actually want your character to be likable, but they're actually really irritating, or they're kind of wooden, or they're actually overshadowed by the supporting characters because they just appear more interesting because you're in that character's head and it's just not interesting in the same way. Like there are so many issues that kind of come out. Very rarely are the issues, say, about the writing itself, because to me, that's just something you can kind of fix later to a degree. It's usually the fleshing out. Or it actually can also be about a lack of planning. Outlines are so important, and it's not something that all writers like to use or agree with the process, but it is very important. Some of the strongest books are the ones that have been really planned out.
Yeah, and you know, speaking as someone who's a pantser, I can attest to the fact that since I don't plot books out, I'm the one who has to rewrite them a million times to keep the whole plot together and keep everything moving along and bringing everything together. So definitely that is something that it really helps in the writing process if you do it. And something else that you've just said is this is the feedback that I myself get from publishers when I'm out on submission, and it's something that many of my writer friends hear as well, is I just didn't connect with the character, or I just didn't connect with the voice. And voice is so integral to story. Is that something you could just expand on a bit for the mm-hmm. listeners? Like, what is voice and how do you help them work on that?
Absolutely. So really kind of when you're talking about the voice, it's really, there's a little bit of a combo happening there. So you, on the one hand, you kind of have the authorial voice, so the voice of the author, which, and then there's also the voice of the main character. And that can be a little more prominent, say, if it's first person. If it's third person, it's a little more distant, so it's not necessarily as clear. But then sometimes they also kind of can compete a bit, or you can kind of feel that maybe they're, or the author is trying to make this character work, so then this character has become kind of awkward. Like, it's, you can see the play. Again, this is, you know, not something that an average reader would be able to tell. This is something that, you know, an experienced editor can look at and be like, okay, this is what's going on with this one. This character is acting younger than her actual age, and it's not appealing, or it's confusing, or it makes the book feel like it should be young adult when it's actually an adult book. I've worked on, you know, books where that's happened, where it becomes suddenly unclear what age group it should be for, because you can have younger characters, like teenagers, as say the protagonists in adult books, but that's always a little trickier to do, because you have to make sure that the narrative voice, which is, right, again, could be the more the character, it could be more the author, like that needs to still have a maturity to it, which sometimes can be lost, you know. So of course, as an editor, when I'm going in and I'm looking at something like this, that's usually something I'm unpacking, even like as I'm reading through the manuscript. Okay, so when does the main character seem actually like appealing, or, you know, when do I connect with them? When don't I connect with them? Which scenarios are that's happening versus the other? And you start seeing the patterns, and you're like, okay, well, I really don't like this character when she's interacting with this other character. But then when she's interacting with her best friend, she's all of a sudden really engaging. But then her best friend doesn't come across very often. So most of the book, she's just this horrible person. Like, you know, she's not meant to be. That's the thing there. So usually for me, it's also sometimes all it really takes is just for me to be like, look, this is what's happening. How would you like to fix this? And then I work with an author just to kind of help brainstorm how to kind of fix those characters and fix that voice as a result. You know, other times, you know, I might have to go a little more in depth and really kind of pinpoint certain scenes if they're what kind of turn a character, because what you can have happen is have a character who is really likable up until a certain scene, and then it completely destroys their character, and then you hate them for the rest of the book. You can have moments like that where it's because it's just something so inconsistent, or just not something you'd ever want to have in a book, and you need someone to be able to be like, okay, this has to be removed. And to remove this, you have to say, fix these other five scenes or something like that as well. So again, it's just having someone in there with the experience and the knowledge to be able to just kind of pinpoint and kind of, you know, unknot all of these things, really getting down to the source of the issue. Because I've had that with authors where they're just like, oh, that's what was wrong. Like, they thought it was, or something else.
And a big frustration for authors is, you know, the longer we spend on a project, whether it's a year or 2 years, we become so immersed in it that there is zero objectivity. Trying to step away from it and see it clearly becomes pretty much impossible. And that is when somebody like you can be so incredibly helpful in giving us a bit of that objectivity and a bit of distance from our own work. Now, in terms of costing, so if, let's say, you've got a manuscript that's about 80,000 words, it's as polished as the writer themselves can make it. They have writing groups. They have people they've shown it to. It's not just a first draft. They've redrafted it multiple times based on feedback that they've gotten from people. More or less, if you can give us like a range estimate of what a manuscript evaluation would cost them mm-hmm. and what a developmental edit would cost them, because I think it's helpful to writers to be able to budget and to know, okay, this is more or less what it's going to cost me as I go into it. And I know you said there's a range of factors that could change that, but just a general idea.
I'll give a range, but this definitely isn't, you know, something to hold editors to, because every editor does have their own their own range and their own costs and things like that. But generally speaking, manuscript evaluations, if on who's doing it, can run anywhere from like, even it could even be like 700, 1500. I think some people might do more to 2000. My manuscript evaluation costs below $1,000 personally. I feel like just with the time that gets put in, that's fair. So usually mine, I would say even for say 80,000 is probably maybe in the, might be around $700. You know, every editor has their own kind of calculations and references and stuff for those kinds of projects. Now, for developmental editing, that one definitely can vary based on how much work a manuscript needs. If it doesn't need tons, and say, again, sticking around the 80,000 word mark, then yeah, maybe it could be as low as, like, say, 1,500 to 2,000. I would say more average developmental edit might be more on the $2,000 to $3,000 range. I realize that's a huge range, but again, every editor has their own way of estimating. And that can also factor in anything like how much time an editor has to, again, how much work a project needs or how fast an author wants something done. Like there are a number of factors that go into those calculations. But that's again, where I would definitely recommend for authors is to have an idea of a budget, whether they share it with the editor or not. But have an idea of how much you're willing, or how much you're, shouldn't say willing, but how much you're able to spend on editing, because that will determine, say, even could be who you work with, because certain editors, you know, will price higher than others depending upon experience and things like that. And it can also depend on, you know, how much work gets done. But again, manuscript evaluations are a great middle ground. If you just want to get an idea of, even if you're just going in the right direction with your novel, right? If there's really something there that's publishable, that's a great way to find out.
Wonderful. Well, that's incredibly helpful, Rachel. Thank you so much.
And that's it for today's episode. If you have any questions about writing or publishing, please email me at theshitaboutwriting@gmail.com and I'll do my best to get them answered for you. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes.
Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues, but for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Hi everyone, this is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram. and I hope to see you there.
Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues, but for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15, when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course. Use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Hi, everyone. This is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.